Nice to see you all. Case number 1-07-1712, Presbytero and Velasquez, United States versus. Good morning.
Good morning, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Patrick Blagan, and together with Jody Garvey and Tom Breen, we represent the appellant in this matter, Ronald Presbytero. In 2002, Mr. Presbytero was tried and then acquitted of a mail fraud scheme where he was alleged to have attempted to defraud the Carpenters Union Trust and Pension Fund and was alleged to have made false statements or omissions on some ERISA forms. Essentially, the government's theory in the first trial of Mr. Presbytero was that he used what the government called fictitious or non-existent subcontractors to avoid paying employee fees to the union for using union workers. In 2003, the government indicted Mr. Presbytero again. And in this indictment, the current indictment, Mr. Presbytero was charged with in count one, with a conspiracy to defraud the United States. That count is no longer an issue. The district court granted Mr. Presbytero's motion for judgment of acquittal, and the government has not appealed that decision. What is at issue is Mr. Presbytero's convictions on counts 2 and 3 of the indictment for making false statements on Presbytero Drywall's corporate tax returns. And it's on this second attempt to convict Mr. Presbytero, unfortunately successful on the second time, that the government engaged in some tactics that should cause this court to reverse. The first and most important of these tactics is that the government constructively amended its indictment through argument, proof, and jury instructions that it requested and got from the district court with regard to count 2 and 3. A constructive amendment of an indictment occurs when the trial proofs, the arguments, the jury instructions expand the charges returned by the grand jury or add new theories of guilt than the one charged by the grand jury. So the starting point, of course, is what did the grand jury charge in counts 2 and 3 of the indictment? Here, what they charged was that Mr. Presbytero caused to be put on two different lines of the corporate return, line 8 for cost of goods sold and line 5 for other costs, numbers that were essentially higher than he truly knew them to be. The government, to prove, and count 3 is essentially the same as count 2, in order to prove these two counts, the government used 3 separate theories to convict him, only one of which was even remotely charged in the grand jury. The theory that you would expect them to have attempted to convict him on was that the numbers were higher than they should have been.
Now, of course, Mr. Presbytero didn't complain before the district court about constructive amendment.
He did, Judge.
Not with this theory in mind.
Well, let me tell you how I think he did. When the jury instructions were discussed, and particularly this jury instruction 51, which the government requested to establish that they can charge cases conjunctively but prove them disjunctively, Mr. Breen objected. And what he didn't say the words constructive amendment, but what he said was, you're now permitting the government to convict this man, this drywaller, for putting the numbers on the wrong line? And Judge Gottschall said yes.
But I don't see that as a clear objection indicating constructive amendment of the indictment. And I don't think it's really a question simply of saying you put it on the wrong line. If you're taking deductions for phony subcontractors and calling that cost of goods sold instead of indicating that payments are being made as wages to employees, that's it means certainly that the cost of goods sold line is wrong. So, I mean, there are a couple of things there. I'm not at all certain that anybody at trial was on notice that a constructive amendment of the indictment objection was being made. And had they been on notice, perhaps there could have been more exploration of this issue at the time.
Well, let me address that in two ways then. The other, I think it was raised at three times. The other time was during the Rule 29 argument of Mr. Breen's at the close of the government's case. Now, he, again, didn't use the words constructive amendment, but he essentially said Judge, you're permitting them to proceed on this new theory, which we've been complaining about since day one. But the last time is in the post-trial motions, there was a section called constructive amendment.
But of course, that's way post-trial. My concern is that at least these earlier things that you're talking about, the jury instruction, the other, could simply be seen as an argument about insufficiency of the evidence, which is a whole different kind of argument.
I don't think that's how Mr. Breen couched it, because he went on a page and a half complaint at the Rule 29, not about the sufficiency of the evidence, but about the fact that they were trying him again for essentially the same conduct, and that he says things like, we never knew what the charges were here, and now we're getting these kind of charges. But be that as it may.
I think now you're making a different objection, which is the ERISA, the relation between this case and the earlier ERISA case, which at the very least is a different point than a constructive amendment of the indictment point.
Well, that may be. I'll discuss it then in the sense of, if we are facing a plain error standard, I think we can meet that standard as well. And the reason is this. The main theory, the one theory that was charged in the indictment, they did not prove. And in light of that, there is an error. I submit that the error is a plain one.
Well, wasn't the government's central theory always that he was reporting payments to subgrant contractors that did not exist, and in this way overstating costs?
I would say that was a theory that they presented in opening statements, along with the theory that the numbers were just too high. They had this seasonal fluctuation theory, which said, you couldn't possibly have been paying this much to install drywall because you never slowed down in the winter months. So I would say that was their two main theories, and the one that popped up in the middle of trial was this wrong line theory. But even under plain error analysis, the reason that Mr. Presbytero probably would have been acquitted, which is the standard under plain error, in addition to that there being error, is that they didn't prove the primary, the argument that's, or the theory charged in the indictment. They didn't prove that he overstated the amounts. Their seasonal fluctuation theory, frankly, did not go very far. They had witnesses who said, yes, things normally slow down in the winter, but we were also busy in the winter.
But why couldn't the jury have believed on the seasonal fluctuations precisely that, and to see the numbers before them, where in many instances the numbers were even higher during the winter, would have allowed the jury to draw the inference that too much was being charged? I wasn't sure that – I'm not saying a jury would have to, but the question is, would a jury be permitted to draw that inference? And I'm not also sure why what Judge Rovner says isn't precisely what the government has been saying, that by trying to claim that these payments to the six supposed subcontractors were the things that were recorded on, you know, line 2, Schedule A, line 8, et cetera, that it was just too high. That's not what they were paying.
Well, their theory along the lines, I believe, that Judge Rovner was discussing was that these subcontractors were fictitional. Not that the money wasn't paid, but their theory essentially was, even if you find the money was paid, you should convict him because there were no such subcontractors.
But it doesn't belong on that. That line is too high if there are no subcontractors.
And it's very clear, it should be, I think, very clear, that theory was never charged in the indictment, and here's why.
I'm looking at the indictment right now, so I'm not sure why that's so clear.
Because line 8 and line 5 are not independent of each other. Line 8 is a total line, including lines 1 through 5. If the government's theory were that line 5 is just it was on the wrong place and it should have been on line 3, then there would be no allegation that line 8 was wrong. Line 8 would not have changed one bit if the amount of $2 million and some change were placed on line 3 or line 5. And that's how I believe you can decide that the theory of wrong lines was never charged.
I see. In fact, I mean, the last line is, in fact, as defendant Presbytero then and there well knew and believed, the cost of goods sold and other costs were less than the sums reported. It seems like the government's proof does address that point.
But not for putting it on a different line.
Well, all told, you know, altogether they were less, as well as whatever the other costs item was.
Well, maybe I didn't make the point as clearly as I could have. if line 5 really should be on line 3, then line 8 does not change.
Line I understand what you're saying, but then they're focusing on something's on line 5, maybe it should be somewhere else, but the whole thing is too high if they're using these phony subcontractors.
Again, I would submit that's not a theory charged in the indictment. Certainly not. I mean, the government obviously drafts the indictments for the grand jury to return, and they can limit it or make it as broad as they choose. The statute itself is pretty broad. It just says any false statements. But when they say things like to wit or in that and then describe what is to be done, and in this sense they said that these numbers were that he well believed that the cost of goods sold and other costs were less than the sums reported, then that's the theory that they have to stick to. And that if something were on a different line but wouldn't affect count 8, that's an amendment to the indictment and was never charged. I think I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve the rest of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Amr Pacha on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, I think have hit it on the head with respect to the issue of constructive indictment. Constructive amendment of the indictment. There was no constructive amendment of the indictment. In fact, there was no surprise prior to trial as to what the government's theory was going to be, because there were pretrial filings that laid out the government's theory. We filed a Santiago proffer prior to trial.
Speaking of the Santiago proffer, can you tell me what, if any, co-conspirator statements were kept out of the trial after Judge Gottschall found the Santiago proffer to be insufficient?
Your Honor, I couldn't really specify at this point in time. That wasn't something that I focused on since it had been excluded as evidence. I'm happy to address that issue in a post-argument filing if you'd like. My suspicion is that it was probably remarks that were made by one of the two defendants, but I honestly can't say it right now. In terms of the constructive amendment of the indictment, there was no constructive amendment because our argument was because the subcontractors were fictitious, the payments purportedly made to these subcontractors were overstated, and they were overstated on line 5 of the applicable returns.
But what about Mr. Blagan's argument that if once you get to line 8, you're just summing it up anyway, and where's the evidence to show that the total number is too high?
Well, the way we addressed that, Judge, was that one of the instructions that the jury was given was that they had to find that line 5 was false. And because they had to do that, that necessarily meant that their decision would not rest upon whether or not they determined that line 8 was false. So, for example, if these were really employees, as the defendants seemed to contend at trial, the amount that appeared on line 5 would have been moved up to line 3, but the total tabulation on line 8 would have remained the same. We accounted for that by specifically ensuring that there was an instruction that made it positively clear that the jury could not convict only if it found line 8 to be false. Line 5 had to be false. And it had to be false in the manner specified in the indictment. The jury specifically received an instruction that said that the falsity had to be in the manner specified in the indictment. And while we did focus on whether or not the subcontractors were fictitious, again, that was all to just show that the amount on line 5 was overstated. So I don't believe that there's any merit to the argument, which was not raised before the district court at all. I would also note that with respect to the pretrial filings, the constructive amendment of the indictment argument that was raised in the post-trial filings was of a different theory. It did allege constructive amendment of the indictment, but the idea there was that the special agent, Helene Seltzer, had given some testimony to the grand jury that was inconsistent with the theory that was pursued at trial. I believe the response that we had to that theory was that the transcript that actually had been cited by the defendants was a transcript that had been testimony of the agent to a different grand jury than
the
one
different grand jury before
right,
the
that actually returned
indictment.
The superseding indictment. So there was no real reference to the theory that you're hearing now for the first time about constructive amendment of the indictment.
So your position would be these post-trial filings are too late?
Yes, Judge. Our theory, our submission is that the plain error standard would apply, and it certainly wasn't an obvious error at all. I don't believe there's any error whatsoever with respect to the way the government presented its case at trial.
Did anybody ever dispute that these were fictitious entities?
I can say this, that in closing argument, Mr. Brunel, the counsel for the defendant, was still contending that Mr. Presbytero did not know that they were fictitious entities. And essentially what happened at closing argument was Mr. Brunel actually closed second, Mr. Martin closed first. Mr. Brunel had an opportunity to discuss this issue and indicated that it was Mr. Martin's client that was really responsible for the workforce, and indicated that Mr. Presbytero was in the dark. And I think given the evidence that we had of Mr. Presbytero's complicity and involvement in fabricating these entities, that just simply wasn't a plausible theory at the end of the day. That evidence included the fact that Mr. Presbytero was the one that ordered all the invoices for these six corporations from Juanita Morgan's company, Stratford Press. Ms. Morgan testified during trial. Notably, from what I recall, neither defense attorney chose to cross-examine her. And the evidence that was admitted in conjunction with her testimony included the actual documentation of the whole process of ordering these invoices. And that documentation included a document that had a specification on the order that each invoice for these fictitious corporations should look different. That, taken in conjunction with the other activities that Mr. Presbytero engaged in, demonstrated his involvement in this offense. Mr. Presbytero is the one that showed Mr. Sklar, the owner of the currency exchange, some documents. Mr. Sklar referred to them as resolutions during the course of his testimony. Perhaps they were articles of incorporation for these companies. Articles of incorporation, which, by the way, had been filed at about the same time by the same firm, firm headed by Mr. Stanley New, who we attempted to call as a witness but were not able to because of a ruling of the court. In addition to ordering up these invoices, Mr. Presbytero also had his secretary prepare the invoices themselves with information provided by Mr. Velasquez. And I'd like to actually turn, if I could, using some of my time, to Mr. Velasquez himself and his participation in this conspiracy. The evidence at trial showed it that this was action in concert between both Mr. Velasquez and Mr. Presbytero in this case.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, if you're going to turn to Mr. Velasquez, I have a question about his entire role in this as charged in count one. Is it the government's theory that Mr. Velasquez has to have had a specific intent to simply to defraud the government, or is it the government's theory that you had to prove and did prove that Mr. Velasquez intended to impede the functions of the Internal Revenue Service?
Well, the way that the count is phrased, Judge, is it says it does say conspiring to defraud by impeding, impairing, obstructing, and defeating. I do think perhaps maybe I don't understand the distinction, but I do think those things are...
Well, if he just had to have a specific intent to defraud the United States, then you might be able to say, as to the rest of the things he did, such as participating in the creation of the phony invoices or walking the checks over to the currency exchange or taking the money back or all the other various things that he did, the amount of work that didn't seem to vary by season, you might just... your argument, as I understand it, has been to say that Mr. Velasquez, to take the other extreme, didn't need to actually sit there and help type the corporate tax returns. Mr. Velasquez didn't have to look at the corporate tax returns. So I'm trying to figure out how close to the corporate tax function did he have to get.
Right. I think there has to be some demonstration of relatedness, I would think.
So and you I think you had to prove that he specifically intended to do something to impede, impair, obstruct, et cetera, the functions of the Internal Revenue Service.
Right. I do, Judge. Okay. I do think we've demonstrated that. And let me actually address that.
Question just a little differently. How could the jury find Velasquez had knowledge of the tax ramifications of this whole subcontractor cash checking agreement or arrangement or scheme or whatever?
There's a number of ways, Judge. First of all, Mr. Velasquez was in charge of all the workers for Presbytero Drywall. The jury could take that into account. When you actually consider what role and function he had in this organization, all the foremen reported to Mr. Velasquez. Now, he, at trial, tried to portray himself as, you know, an everyday man, dressed in that fashion, and there were references to his dress in the court as a way of demonstrating that this guy is just an everyday Joe. He doesn't know what's going on. But the evidence at trial was that he actually was responsible for all these workers.
But see, even though he's responsible for all these workers, isn't it possible that someone like Velasquez, and given what you said, that he was the supervisor, was doing all these things because he wanted to obey his boss? He wanted to help his boss out. That doesn't mean he acted with the intent to defraud the IRS or knew about the false filings. He could have thought, hey, just more profits into the company.
Well, when somebody in his position was falsifying, in total, all of the work records of this company, Mr. Velasquez surely had to know, Your Honor, that there was no possible way to make legitimate filings with the IRS. There is no way you could do that. He was coming in on a weekly basis, sometimes other people, and providing false information about hours worked by fictitious corporations. Mr. Velasquez was familiar with the concept of business deductions because by virtue of the fact he was aware of the concept of deductions from his own returns, which the jury saw.
In other words, with that information that he was supplying to Ms. Gordon, well, what does the record tell us about what he knew about the subcontractor information that he was supplying to Ms. Gordon? Are you saying it?
Well, the evidence that the subcontractors were fictitious is clear from a number of things, Judge. First,
the evidence that he knew they were fictitious, right. I assume, mm-hmm. is what you mean to say. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the thing is, with respect to whether or not Mr. Velasquez was aware that they were fictitious, flows from the fact that once you've established that they're fictitious and Mr. Velasquez is reporting hours that the subcontractors worked, then if you're actually providing information about how many hours those subcontractors worked when they don't exist, how is that possible? It's not.
What I'm not getting here is, are you saying that it was he who was making up the hours?
That's a possible reading of the testimony, Judge, and the evidence. Exactly right. Because Maureen Gordon is typing up these invoices from each of the six subcontractors. She's given information about how much money each subcontractor is owed. That information is coming in part from Mr. Velasquez.
In part, you say.
Right. There were at times Ms. Gordon testified that at times other individuals brought in information from the field relating to the work performed by the subcontractors, which she then typed up. I would note, with respect to Ms. Gordon, in terms of her testimony at trial, she was still, at the time of trial, working for Mr. Presbytero's son. Now, with respect to her testimony,
is there ever any effort to explore criminal charges against Ms. Gordon?
Judge, I cannot answer that question. I actually came onto this case after it had been initially indicted and certain decisions had been made.
But no one...
I do believe that she... I do know that certain individuals may have received proffer letters from the government prior to talking to us. I cannot tell you right now whether or not she received one or not. She may have had some sort of immunity, but I can't recall. I'd have to look at the record, Judge.
Okay,
but the interesting thing there was the currency exchange cashing arrangement was set up by Mr. Velasquez himself. He asked Mr. Sklar to cash these checks through his currency exchange. Now, the company, Presbytero Drywall, incurred $50,000 in expenses and fees from cashing these checks at a currency exchange, which was by itself very odd. And it was Mr. Velasquez that would often go in and actually cash these checks himself. So in terms of the fictitious nature of the corporations, if Mr. Velasquez himself is going in and cashing his checks...
Would you say that that's your most important piece of evidence, the fact that he was going into his friend, cashing the checks, and taking the money out?
I think that's a powerful piece of evidence. I think, in this case, I'd be honest, it's a collection of different pieces of evidence that the jury could rely upon. I wouldn't say that there's one individual piece of evidence that is the nail in the coffin with respect to Mr. Velasquez, if I may phrase it that way. But Mr. Velasquez would also call Mr. Sklar and advise him prior to actually coming in to collect the money from cashing the checks, how much money would be necessary that day. So Mr. Velasquez sets up the arrangement for the currency exchange cashing operation, advises Mr. Sklar on a periodic basis as to how much money is necessary, is frequently the one that actually cashes the checks. He's familiar with the concept of business deductions, and yet for several years he goes through this process of faking and fabricating these transactions. This is very similar to the type of situation that the Second Circuit had in the Antanasio case. In fact, even more so, because in the Antanasio case, what we had there was we had an attorney that had actually fabricated two transactions.
But, you know, your opponents distinguished the Antanasio case precisely because he was an attorney. Mm-hmm. Now, an attorney you could expect would be aware that the reason you create a large paper trail to support, say, capital gains treatment might be to defraud the IRS. You know, suppose you get audited, whatever, you file your tax forms and you have made it difficult for the IRS to find out why this is fraudulent. And I think Mr. Velasquez's point is, here he is, maybe he's the chief construction supervisor for Presbytero Drywall, but he's not an attorney. He is certainly involved. I think a jury could say, yes, he's involved in a lot of the paperwork, a lot of the business side of things for Presbytero Drywall. If he's going over, he's getting the money. It's his friends whose names are on some of the subcontractor documents, as I recall. He's filling in hours. But can we take that next step and say he is creating this paper trail in the same way that the lawyer was in the Antanasio case?
I think the answer is yes, Judge, and here's why. First of all, with respect to the Antanasio case, the Second Circuit never actually relied upon the defendant's position as an attorney, or Mr. Milan's position as attorney. They might not have been the actual defendant there. Mr. Milan's position as an attorney in determining that the evidence was sufficient. There's no reference to his actual stature as an attorney. I also think
in that case, though, if we can go back to that, he specifically designed the financial transactions so they could be treated as long-term capital gains for tax purposes.
Well, I don't know if it's clear from actually reading that opinion that the Second Circuit said that he specifically designed those transactions for the purpose of making sure that they were long-term capital gains eligible. I don't think there was any evidence. I took a look at that opinion. I believe what Your Honor may be reading from is the district court's inference from that opinion, but I don't think that's actually something that appears in the opinion itself. What we have here is we have Mr. Velasquez designing a series of transactions. He's the one that's actually right in the middle of these transactions, making them happen.
Right, but that's at the direction of his boss.
Well, he may have taken some direction from his boss, but I do believe that given the fact that he participated in these transactions over the period of several years, he was the one that actually realized, he must have realized, that he's cashing all these checks for six fictitious corporations, bringing them to the currency exchange on a regular basis. He's advising Mr. Sklar how much money is required. And then we have all the other information about how the subcontractors are fictitious. No filings with the IRS. We go out to all the locations to try to locate these subcontractors. They're not there. The invoices that are typed up by Maureen Gordon with the information that Mr. Velasquez provides are never sent out anywhere. Mr. Velasquez never apparently, during the course of this, sends an invoice via mail, nor does Mr. Presbytero either. And again, it's worth noting, Mr. Velasquez is supervising all the workers here. He has a role of responsibility. And that role of responsibility, surely in a corporation that's a multi-million dollar corporation, would encompass knowledge of the fact that you take business deductions. You keep track of what you spend. When you have a job, you make note of what your time and materials are.
So are you saying the jury should have drawn an inference about the tax consequences of this simply from Mr. Velasquez? I think you have certainly shown that Mr. Velasquez knows that this is running as a cash operation, basically. He's getting cash at the currency exchange. There's a lot of testimony that the workers are paid in cash, unless maybe on occasion some union people are hanging around. But on the whole and by and large, it's a cash operation. So is there some taint here to running your business as a cash operation?
Well, it's not only that, Judge, but there's no actual real explanation for why this whole enterprise occurred. There is no other plausible explanation for why this would be done other than an illegitimate tax purpose. And the reason that is because of the seasonality evidence that we had at trial.
Did you have any evidence about why Mr. Velasquez would have a motive to cooperate in that kind of thing? I certainly can see from Mr. Presbytero, but why Mr. Velasquez?
There was no motive evidence, Judge. I don't believe that we did have anything that explained what his motivation was. What I would focus on, though, Judge, is that the district court, in saying that there could have been some other reason, gave two reasons for what this could be other than an improper tax purpose. And I think that's important. There is no other, or at least the jury could properly infer, based on the evidence and the explanation that the defense gave, that there was no other legitimate purpose behind this or other intended purpose behind this other than to defraud the IRS. First, the district court said that this possibly could have been a means by which Mr. Presbytero could siphon off money from his company. That didn't make any sense because Mr. Presbytero was the 100% shareholder of Presbytero Drywall. Why would you siphon off money from your own company unless you were attempting to hide it so that you wouldn't have to report it? The other explanation that came at trial from the defense was this issue of there being a union problem. That didn't make sense for a number of reasons. One reason it didn't make sense was because of the seasonality evidence. If, in fact, the defendants intended to use this as an end run around the unions to pay workers, the seasonality evidence showed that the payments, there was no seasonal fluctuation in payments made to these workers. Common sense also enters into the equation for the jury as well. They could have looked at this situation and said to themselves, well, you know, if it really was a problem with unions and you could get out of it by hiring a subcontractor, why not hire a real subcontractor? Why have six fictitious corporations at work? Why pay them $50,000, the currency exchange order, in order to actually cash these checks? And then the other additional problem beyond that, Your Honors, is that with respect to this claim that this was a way to solve a union problem, we do know from the case that was before Judge Dara that and this was not before the jury, I'll concede that, but we do know from that case that the union agreement, the collective bargaining agreement that Presbytero Drywall had with the unions, did not permit hiring subcontractors that were not themselves subject to a collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, you had mentioned that, I was just going to say, in your reply brief in footnote 2, but as you say, it wasn't before the jury in this case. Wouldn't it have been your burden to put it there?
Well, Judge, I don't think that's the case. An explanation was given by the defense during the course of the case, but there was no evidence to actually substantiate that theory. In fact, the evidence that we did already have in the record disproved that theory. I only merely note that parenthetically, I believe, and I think I may even put in a footnote in my reply brief. It all goes to show that in the course of my argument here today, that's the very last thing that I've actually noted. It's a side note. There was no evidence that there was any way to get around a collective bargaining problem by hiring subcontractors. But that's a parenthetical addition to the fact that if you look at the evidence that the jury had before it, it had that seasonality evidence before it to show that there wasn't any seasonal fluctuation.
So you have to be arguing that if the jury thought there was some other explanation, it would have been pure speculation.
It would have, because the only explanation came during the course of opening argument and closing argument. This idea that, well, we had a collective bargaining agreement and this is the way to get out of it. The only way that came in and came before the jury was through defense counsel. There was nothing that was introduced at trial that indicated that by hiring subcontractors that somehow this would solve a problem.
Well, can defense counsel do that in so far as they're just trying to plant a reasonable doubt in the jury's mind about how well your explanation hangs together?
Well,
it's not really evidence per se, but it might be something that.
Well, this explanation came in opening argument, I think, at first, and in opening statement, I should say. An opening statement is supposed to be a forecast of what the evidence during the case will show. There was no evidence during the course of the case that by hiring these subcontractors you could get out of a union problem. But more importantly, the seasonality evidence demonstrated that there was no fluctuation. this money wasn't going strictly to pay these workers.
So and I assume there was no jury instruction that dealt with this question. You're saying it was raised in opening statement, and was it also argued in closing argument?
It was definitely argued in
and
closing
And was there
argument.
A request for a jury instruction, since your view was there wasn't sufficient evidence in the record, and therefore that wasn't a legitimate argument?
Was I think the jury was surprised on several occasions that the arguments of counsel are not evidence. And so
Specifically on that question.
Not on this specific point.
No, but that's what I'm saying on that. This specific question, you alerted to it in opening statement. This is going to be part of the defense. Your view is there's not enough evidence, and also the law doesn't support that. I'm just asking if there was a jury instruction at the conclusion of the trial that addressed this in any way.
There was not, Judge. There was not. But given the fact that the evidence actually disproved the theory at trial, and because of that, and because of the general instruction that an argument from counsel is not evidence, I consider that sufficient to actually address that point. With respect to the reasonableness of the sentence as to Mr. Presbytero, our position is that with respect to the application of the guidelines, to the extent this court finds that Mr. Velasquez actually was a criminal participant in this case, then the guidelines were, as a procedural matter, improperly calculated. I would just note
But that's your only complaint, as I understand, about the acquittal on count one as it pertains to Mr. Presbytero. He's been acquitted, but it might come back in as relevant conduct for two and three?
That's right, Judge. So, and to just to clarify, we are not asking this court to revisit Mr. Presbytero's acquittal on count one. We're asking the court to revisit Mr. Velasquez's acquittal on count one. Mm-hmm. What we are asking, though, that it is with respect to the sentence that was imposed on Mr. Presbytero, that this court visit the issue of whether or not the guidelines were properly calculated by taking into account that Mr. Velasquez was a criminal participant. And notably with respect to that decision, the decision would be made by a preponderance of the evidence and not beyond a reasonable doubt. And our submission would be, obviously, given the argument that I've given here, that even if we hadn't proved it beyond a reasonable doubt, it certainly was showing that was made by the preponderance. And I'd emphasize again, with respect to the jury, the standard of review here is, time-worn. Your Honors have heard it many times before. The standard is whether or not the jury's decision was wholly irrational. It was not wholly irrational for this jury to conclude, based on the extensive participation Mr. Velasquez had in the fabrication of these documents, the cashing of these documents over the course of several years, his position in the company, returns that were filed on his behalf that showed his knowledge of deductions, and the explanation that was proffered at trial, which the evidence itself disputed, that he was a member of this conspiracy to defraud the IRS. Now, with respect to the unreasonableness of the sentence as to Mr. Presbytero, I would note, I'm running short on time, that with respect to that sentence, one of the factors that the district court relied upon was that Mr. Presbytero had assumingly spent a lot of money on defense counsel, Mr. Breen and his associates. There was no evidence in the record. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that Mr. Breen, being a seasoned professional that he is, charges a fair sum of money for his services, but there was no evidence in the record as to what type of fee arrangement Mr. Breen had with Mr. Presbytero, whether or not he had some sort of limited fee arrangement or what have you. But more importantly, this court's decision in Siriram has already laid down post-Booker under the 3553A analysis that the amount of money a defendant pays to an attorney is not an appropriate basis upon which to deliver a sentence. And I did see in one of the briefs that was filed that defense counsel suggested that that was a reference to the amount of money that was paid that was made in passing. I would respectfully submit that the transcript of the proceedings demonstrates that the judge was concerned about two things: the amount of money that Mr. Presbytero had expended in fighting these charges, as well as the stress involved in finding these charges. But the Siriram decision, I think, answers this point. I would note also, since we filed our brief, I believe that there's been a GVR from the Supreme Court on the Siriram decision. However, it's the government's position that the Siriram decision should just be affirmed. I believe we filed a statement to that effect in light of Gall. And I'd also emphasize that this court's decision in McElrath demonstrates that this Court's post-Booker practice with respect to judging the reasonableness of sentences has not really changed. Gall really reaffirms a lot of the things that this Court was saying.
Gall says you can't have a sliding scale, though. I mean, this Court is certainly taking a look at what we've said in opinions in light of Gall.
Right. And I think Gall does say, though, that a major departure should be supported by a more significant justification than a minor one. So by necessity, we do have to look at the proper guidelines calculation and then consider what type of departure was awarded. And in this case, if you assume that the guidelines were correct as the district court calculated them, which we submit they were not, the departure here was still quite substantial. And the rationales that supported it, A, were impermissible, as I've just talked about, with respect to this issue of how much money did Mr. Presbytero spend fighting the government. But there are other things about the decision that were troubling as well. Mr. Presbytero got credit for defrauding the government in a tax case. In a tax case, the government is always the victim. How it is that can be mitigating and a basis for reduction in sentence in a tax case makes no sense. Now, with respect to one of the other issues here, the risk of recidivism, Mr. Presbytero, till today, maintains that he is innocent. Mr. Breen, who had an opportunity to address the court at sentencing, instead of actually focusing on the 3553A factors during his presentation, the sole focus of his presentation at sentencing, Your Honors, was that Mr. Presbytero should not have been prosecuted and that the government was out to get him. And Mr. Presbytero said, my attorney said it all. That does not indicate somebody that has absolutely nil chance of recidivism. And for those reasons, Your Honors, we'd ask that this court send back the district court's judgment as to Mr. Velazquez and order that he be sentenced on count one, that it affirm the convictions on counts two and three as to Mr. Presbytero, and order that he be resentenced consistent with the guidelines determination that finds that Mr. Velazquez was a criminal participant in this case. Thank you.
Mr. Brasher. Mr. Martin, good morning.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. Just to answer a few of the panel's questions during the government's argument, the statements that were excluded in the Santiago proffer were the statements that Mr. Velazquez and Mr. Presbytero made to Leonard Scar, the currency exchange owner, in the court to give him the limiting instruction. Ms. Gordon did testify. She did receive a proffer letter. She was in we didn't cross-examine her on it, so it probably didn't come out in the record. Turning to the case, I want to get one thing straight and try and talk frank to the court, and that is that Presbytero Drywall was a real live drywall company which was responsible for the installation of a lot of drywall in residential housing projects during the boom in the mid-90s. They had a lot of workers. The testimony was that there was at least 100 men at times who were working installing drywall. The foreman witnesses testified before the grand jury that these workers were paid in cash. These deductions on the tax return corresponded to the amount of money that Presbytero was paying the workers when you multiplied it by the sheets of drywall that Presbytero ordered.
How was that demonstrated through any kind of record, though? I mean, that's the problem with cash, isn't it? It's easy to exchange. How can we know? I mean, did we have a lot of the workers testify? I didn't think you did. How do we know how much the workers were paid and how much drywall was installed? I think there were all sorts of questions about that.
The two foremen testified, and they were responsible for crews. As far as the drywall that was ordered, it was brought out during the cross-examination of the case agent by Mr. Presbytero. In the first case, and this is in the record, the government's whole theory was
you
that...
In the ERISA case?
In the ERISA case. Now, yeah. Mr. Velazquez is not a defendant, but this was part of the pretrial motions. The government's whole theory was that all this work was done, all these drywall sheets were put up, and it was not reported to the union. In filing 161, which is Mr. Presbytero's sentencing memorandum, he attached a spreadsheet that the government submitted in the first case, Exhibit 8, and it lists all the drywall which Presbytero Drywall Company had ordered. And they ordered drywall during the winter months. They ordered January of 96, 12,000 sheets of drywall. July of 95, there's also 12,000 sheets of drywall.
So this evidence was before the jury in the case that we now have?
It was before the jury in the form of Mr. Burnell, who was one of Mr. Presbyterio's lawyers, cross-examined of the case agent. He walked her through and said, look, they claim $2 million for a business deduction on a tax return. If you multiply, the workers were paid what was called piece rate. They were paid piece rate because if you can become a journeyman carpenter by walking into a union office, at least back then, paying a fee, and now you're entitled to $35 an hour, $28 an hour, whatever the rate was back then. And Mr. Burnell walked through all the drywall that was ordered and said, look, if the rate for taping, scraping, and cleaning up the processes in drywall occurred, if that all occurred and they were paid $15 an hour, as there was testimony in the record, and you multiply the sheets of drywall, it comes out almost to a T deductions.
But let's get back, though, to Mr. Velasquez's participation in this conspiracy. He has to know, or at least a jury could conclude, that he knows that the six subcontractors are fictitious. There's a lot of evidence about that. He's nonetheless furnishing figures about how many hours are attributable to each of these six companies. And he's doing something dishonest right there. He's not saying, you know, Jorge Martinez, you know, hung 15 sheets of drywall today. He's saying, you know, whatever it was, Armando Contreras Taping Service did it, or one of the others. So we need to think of this from the point of view of how the jury might have put this all together. And if he's helping Mr. Presbyterio run this business where you just can't tell who's doing what and how much is being paid, why can't you allow the jury to draw this from circumstantial evidence, the inference that Mr. Velasquez is, in fact, trying to make life hard for the tax authorities?
Because of the crime charge in the indictment, Your Honor, the crime here is not that Mr. And let's look at what he did.
Well, let's, you know, count one is they conspired and agreed with each other to defraud the United States by impeding, et cetera, the lawful functions of the IRS. So that's why I phrased it the way I did. Why couldn't a jury, knowing what Mr. Velasquez, or hearing evidence about, I should say, what Mr. Velasquez did, draw the inference that Mr. Velasquez knows he's trying to keep things very opaque for the tax authorities? That's a profitable strategy for a company because people don't like paying taxes.
Because the crime is just not that he was somehow aware of or involved in creation of these records, which were not given to the accountant, which were not given to the IRS. That's not the crime. My opponent just admitted there has to be some linkage to the IRS.
And that's what I'm saying. Why? Go ahead.
Well, to take it just the tiniest bit further, why couldn't a jury think that Mr. Velasquez at the least knew and understood that one purpose, if not the purpose, of the arrangement was to reduce or manipulate the company's tax liability?
Because there is no evidence in the record of this. This was a conspiracy of two. Mr. Velasquez is not charged with conspiring with the workers to avoid the payment of their taxes. He was charged with conspiring with Mr. Presbyterio so that these phony business deductions, and if you take the concept that the work was actually performed, I don't know how phony they really were, but these business deductions that are on the tax return, it was filed by the corporation, occurred. And there is no linkage, there is no evidence that Mr. Velasquez had any knowledge whatsoever of what Presbyterio Drywall did on its tax returns.
But, of course, we have the evidence that Mr. Velasquez, that evidence came out, his own experience with deductions on his personal tax returns.
And that's true.
That was presented.
And
so, you know, I have the same, I mean, it's not just all of his actions, as Judge Roebner and Judge Wood outlined. We also have the fact that he files his personal tax returns. He's familiar with deductions, what deductions are, and why can't the jury put two and two together even though there's no direct conversation of the parties?
The corporate tax returns deductions are deductions of a different kind than personal deductions.
But you don't need to know the details of the deductions. You just need to know that you are making it easy for the corporation to avoid whatever the lawful tax consequences are. Mr. Velasquez probably doesn't need to know about 1099s. He probably doesn't need to know about, you know, the requirement of paying FICA and Medicare and all the rest of the taxes if it were an employee. But he is aware, a jury could include that he's aware that when you don't tell the IRS what's really going on, you can probably manipulate your taxes. And I don't think the government even needs to show that it lost money over the...
And I'm not saying the government has to show it lost money, but they do have to show a component of knowledge on Mr. Velasquez's
part. If you look at the evidence favorably to the government, as we must, it seems to me that the effect of the subcontractor check cashing arrangement was to divert company funds beneath the table, as it were. In other words, make it appear that the company is paying subcontractors when in fact he's going to Mr. Sklar and he's converting the checks into cash.
But there is no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Velasquez knew how Presbyterian Drywall dealt with the IRS. For all he knew, they didn't put anything on their tax returns. They didn't take any deductions. The false records is one thing, but you need linkage or relatedness, as the government said, and that's where there's no evidence in the record.
Everyone understands that a key reason that people do these things is to evade tax liability. He doesn't have to know precisely how the company's tax returns are prepared. He surely knows, or a jury could conclude that he knows, that one purpose, as I said, if not the purpose, of this kind of arrangement is to reduce a company's tax liability on false pretenses. And that's the problem that you have to deal with.
And that assumes that
taxes are not some, you know, exotic idea. We all pay our taxes.
And, Your Honor, I would just like to get back to the indictment, because the indictment charged in paragraph 7 that the manner in which the IRS was defrauded was by the taking of these business deductions, and that's where there is no evidence in this record and no evidence upon which a jury could even infer that. It just wasn't there, and Judge Gottschall found that after hearing the trial, after seeing the jury. That was her conclusion, and the standard of review is not a substitute for lack of proof.
Paragraph 7, though, is dealing with overt acts that Presbytero committed. Velasquez is mentioned in paragraph 3 and paragraph 4 and paragraph 6. So that,
I say I'm out of time, but just to answer Your Honor's question, paragraph 7 was the acts in furtherance of conspiracy, not actually the overt acts. The overt acts were again charged later in paragraph 1. And the only two overt acts in the statute of limitations were the filing of these tax returns. The business records, the payment of workers, that all occurred more than 6 years before the indictment's return. I'd like to speak longer, but the red light is on.
Well, the government took an extra minute, so I'm going to give you that extra minute as well.
Let
me just ask you this, though. Other than the tax motives, what other reason would there be for Velasquez to go to the length he went to create or to give the appearance that the six entities existed? And this whole siphoning off business doesn't make any sense when it's his company.
No, and it wasn't our position that the money was siphoned. The reason was because of the problems Presbyterian Drywall had with the union. This was more than a lawyer's argument. Let's not forget that Ronald Presbytero was indicted for essentially labor fraud for under-reporting the hours to the union. The foreman testified about how someone could just walk in the union office and become a union member. Ms. Gordon gave testimony that the laborers were not carried on books as union employees. And Sklar testified that when it all ended, Mr. Presbytero said, hey, you know, we've been having union problems. So there is some evidence in the record of that motivation in addition to what we argued. I just want to say in the few seconds I have left about the seasonal variation, the government didn't submit a summary chart which compared months. They rely on the testimony of the agent. In their reply brief, they cherry-pick numbers. If you go back and review these checks and add them up, and I don't expect the court to do that because it's really the government's burden, but they didn't provide the summary chart. But there was tapering off in winter months, and there were spikes in the summer months. And on top of that, drywall was ordered in the summer months. The two highest months where payments occurred for all six companies were August of 95 and October of 96. In the summer, you see the total amounts for all six companies going over $200,000 each month. In the winter months, it's generally under $200,000. There may be one exception. But again, they didn't give this court or the lower court some kind of, or the jury, some kind of chart in which you could compare all these numbers. And the seasonal variation record, if you look at the checks and you add them up, it's not borne out by the record. Thank you.
What?
Nine.
Make it 10, because everyone's had an extra minute.
Thank you. I don't want to step on Mr. Martin's toes with regard to his argument, but one of the court was asking, I think, for some other why it wouldn't be improper for the jury to infer that this cash business was done for tax purposes. There is another clear inference for why it was cash, is that these were seasonal-type workers who didn't have bank accounts and wanted to be paid in cash, and that was part of the evidence as well. So there's clearly reasons that they were using cash that could be that Mr. Velasquez could have in his mind, other than simply, oh, there must be a tax fraud going on here because cash is being used. The reason I argue that is because obviously if Mr. Velasquez goes back, then the 4 points may come back into a play for Mr. Presbytero. I wanted
actually,
to just
I wondered about I wonder these seasonal about. Workers since I mm-hmm. wondered if they all had their green cards, to be honest, but I know that's not in the record.
Nor is it charged, but there right. certainly was evidence that they wanted cash rather than checks. With regard to Mr. Bacciu's arguments regarding the constructive amendment, the only thing I wanted to point out was that in the post-trial motion, there is a constructive amendment argument, and it is not exactly the same argument that we make in the brief, the primary reason for that being count one was still in play at the time of the post-trial motions. But the post-trial motion does say that in light of this evidence, meaning evidence that we thought kind of fell apart about the seasonal fluctuation, the government altered its proof and theory at trial and argued that Presbytero was guilty of the charges in the indictment because he issued the checks to the fictitious entities and entered the amounts paid to the workers on line 5 of the return instead of line 3. So I think the issue was preserved, and we don't have to suffer the vagaries of plain error. But now I'd like to move on to what we consider to be the utmost significant issue in this case, and that is the sentencing imposed by Judge Gatto.
Let's talk about some of these rather unusual things that were taken into consideration.
I won't argue that some of them were not unusual, but specifically with regard to how much counsel was paid, I agree you should look at the transcript. The transcript will show that Judge Gottschall made that remark. It seemed like an off-the-cuff remark in the middle of her discussion of the stress and the pressure that had been on Mr. Presbytero for 10 years and facing two separate charges by the government. She certainly didn't say, this is the reason I'm doing it. It was kind of as an aside. I wasn't there, but I assume she was sort of jokingly addressing Mr. Breen about
Look,
that.
I have now, for my entire career, wondered how people could withstand the stress of investigation, indictment, trial. I'll wonder on my deathbed. But stress has never been one of, you know, the things we could take into consideration ever since the guidelines came into play.
Well, I think that this case is different from the typical stress. And on that point, the government didn't argue that Judge Gottschall's finding about the stress of the multiple cases and the investigation lasting so long, the only thing they objected to and the only thing they addressed with regard to that in their brief was this issue of money paid to defense lawyers. So,
but the court does say that. I mean, I know you're making a valiant effort to cause us to disregard her comment that he'd spend a good part of his life savings defending against charges brought by the government, but I just don't see how we can read that out of the transcript, basically. So even if you're right about stress, and even if she's trying to make a point that, in a sense, deterrence has been satisfied and punishment has been satisfied and 3553A-type factors are, you know, will be addressed by a lower sentence, and maybe she's, I don't know quite how you get there, but let's suppose you can. She does make this comment about spending the life savings, and that's really not something that can be taken into account, not to mention her comment about modestly mitigating because mm-hmm. the government was the victim. I found that shocking.
I thought you might want me to address that, so I'll take them in turn.
That's a little scary, too.
With regard to the payment of the money, here's what I'll say. She says it in the middle of a sentence where she's talking about the pressure and stress, and she does not refer back to it when she summarizes her reasons. So it's really kind of an aside, and some judges are different than others. Some engage in asides with defense lawyers. I don't think anybody walked out of the courtroom thinking the reason she gave this sentence was because of money paid to her defense lawyers. But
my concern is the reason she gave the sentence, not the reason. But be that as it may, why don't you go on to the government is the victim, so it's not so bad.
All right. I just want to address one more thing about the money paid. This is a case where the defense begged the government to try these cases together. When they found out before the first trial that there was going to be a second indictment coming for a tax case, the defense asked to continue the trial. So when the defense and the defendant himself tries to mitigate the costs that he's required to expend, I think maybe you can take into account that the government tried him twice and made him spend the money for two trials when it could have done it once. But let me go to the part about modestly mitigating. It certainly can be argued that it shouldn't be mitigating at all, that the government is the victim. And when Judge Gottschall says modestly mitigating, I presume what she means is that I'm taking this slightly into account because I've seen multiple fraud cases and multiple tax cases related to fraud cases where people were duped of their life savings and those sorts of things. That's clearly what she said, and clearly she took that into account. How much did she take it into account? She doesn't say, and I don't think Gall requires the court to look into it that deeply. She gave her reasons in her summary for why she was imposing a sentence of 24 months, which is a significant incarceration, plus she imposed a $50,000 fine.
But let's go back to Gall for a minute. I think Gall does require district court judges to give a reasonable explanation of the sentence that they're choosing. And if the judges are giving a basis for the sentence that is impermissible, like it doesn't matter if you defraud the government, how can we let a sentence like that stand after Gall?
Here's why. I think you can look at it as the distinction of comments that are being made off the cuff and then the summary explanation of the reason she imposed the sentence, which do not include the reasons that the government is complaining about. It's as if the judge went through a 10-minute recitation of what she was thinking and what she was doing, and then filed a written submission saying, these are the reasons I did it.
Unfortunately, I think that's probably exactly what Judge Gottschall did. She was thinking out loud, but mm-hmm. we don't know how many of these thoughts motivated the final sentence and how many did not.
Well, I think we know what the primary thoughts were that motivated the sentence. That is Mr. Presbytero's age, the lack of any chance of recidivism, and
before,
which is
very young.
I agree. That's what I meant. He was such a young man. He had his whole life in front of him to do good things. That 24 months was a significant deterrent. That the chance of recidivism was zero. And
but I don't know how she could say that.
And here I have trouble with, you know, looking at the sentencing. She puts all these factors out there. To me, she's not giving like a value judgment, or she's not ranking them, or she's not saying, I'm just kind of discussing these now, but now I'm relying on these here. And these different factors, she spends a little time with each of these factors. So it's not just like a throwaway on on certain of the, you know, you're trying to put them lesser in value, you know, really no impact on the government, because she refers to this tax case as a garden variety tax fraud case, which I think ties into that mitigation statement she's making. And, you know, so I'm saying you can look throughout the sentencing transcript, and she's making reference to a variety of these factors. So I don't see how you can argue that there were certain ones that she definitely relied on, or those were really the ones that counted in the sentence. That's what I'm having trouble. You know, where is that in the, you know, how am I to make that distinction on this record?
I think that how you can make the distinction is when she summarizes her reasons at the end. And that's just, I mean, she obviously said the things that are in the record. How much she relied on them is not clear, but even if she relied only on the legitimate things, a 24-month sentence is appropriate, is not unreasonable, and under Gaul, the only thing the prosecutor really wants to do is substitute his own judgment. That kind of sentence is too light for someone who did what they think he did. It's 27 months below the guideline range. The government gives 50%, 30%, 60% departures for all sorts of cooperation. They can't reasonably be heard to complain after Gaul that a sentence of 24 months imprisonment, which is only 27 months less and not down to probation or something like that, is unreasonable or a violation of Gaul. In the Sirium case that the government raised, and they accurately pointed out that it's been sent back, so there is no case now currently saying you can't use payments to attorneys. But in the Sirium case, Judge Posner said that Judge Dara was in cloud cuckoo land in imposing the sentence. And what he meant by that is he gave a sentence that was so untied to the loss amount that wasn't established, and the government was asking for 18 years. That's the kind of case that, and that one was still sent back after the Gaul opinion came out. That's the kind of case where you could decide that a judge was so unreasonable or so abused her discretion.
Wasn't it?
Excuse me?
Wasn't the sentence a day?
I thought it was no custody at all. I thought it might have been probation in Sirium or close to it. And, you know, maybe Judge Posner was right that was cloud cuckoo land. But 27 months off for this person with this background is not cloud cuckoo land. Notably, the government agreed with the multiple character letters and those sorts of things that Mr. Presbytero presented at sentencing, and said that, yes, that's an accurate portrayal of his character, except we have this period of doing things that the government thinks were not quite kosher. So they've agreed that he is generally a good man who was hardworking and had wonderful relationships with the community. To take the position now that 24 months is inappropriate for somebody like that, it doesn't stand. And I know I had a minute, so I'm almost done with it probably. But the one thing that disturbed me the most was this characterization of Mr. Presbytero's response to, do you want to make a statement? And he said, no, Mr. Breen said it all, as somehow obstinate. First of all, the district court was obviously in the best position to determine whether he was being obstinate or not. But saying my lawyer has said everything in writing, in pleadings, in orally, is certainly not obstinate and doesn't call for a reversal of the sentence. Thank you.
I want to thank all of our lawyers. The case will be taken under advisement.